The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
All right. Well, good afternoon and welcome to City Bible Forum today. Thank you for being here. My name is Russell Matthews. We want to welcome you today. And we're going to be welcoming Al Stewart back with the Ecclesiastes, an honest look at life series. Today's talk is going to be Groundhog Day. All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and start in Ecclesiastes 1. I'm going to start at the sentence mark number 1, and then we'll have Al come on up. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor, at which he toils under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the sea comes from, streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. There is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. All right. Hope the talk's a little more cheery.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Okay, thank you. Good, you are awake. All right. How did your day begin today? For me, kind of, I guess, pretty much like most days, the alarm went. Kind of felt a bit too early, staggered out of bed. I did make it to the gym this morning, came home, quick breakfast, then on the bus into town. And everyone on the bus was really excited. No, they weren't. It's just the usual bus full of people. Everyone with teddy bear eyes just sitting there, right? And they're kind of on the way into town, and then you get to work. And do you think you'll remember today? 15th of April 2010, will you remember it? Almost certainly not. In fact, if you're like me, probably regularly you feel like you're living in Groundhog Day. Do you remember that movie? Can you just kind of nod a little bit if you've... Anyone nod, kind of hand move just a little if you've seen it? Yes, here we are. There is a very young Bill Murray. In fact, I don't think Bill Murray was ever actually that young. I think this has been doctored, this photo. If you haven't seen the movie, it's worth a look. It's very funny. Bill Murray gets stuck, snowed into this little American town, and for some quirk of thing, has to repeat the same day over and over and over again. And it's very funny until you actually think about what life is really like, which kind of feels that way. And we do, don't we? We do the same things over and over again. I got the calculator out and I worked out if you sleep 7 hours a day, in the last year you've slept just a little more than 2,500 hours. And yet you'll be tired tonight and you'll have to sleep again and then again and again. Or you've eaten or perhaps prepared 1,000 meals and yet you'll get hungry again. You've had a shower, you've gone 365 times and yet you'll be tired and sweaty tonight, and on it goes. And Woody Allen said 90% of life is just turning up. You know what that means? 90% of life is totally unmemorable. You will not remember 90, maybe more. Just life is just the same bland thing that happens again and again. You work till you're 65. If you study hard at school, we're told you can get an exciting job. Exciting actually means stressful, okay? So you can be stressed at work. Or if you didn't study hard, you can get a boring job and kind of be bored. Or if you're like me, you can manage to be bored and stressed at the same time. I'm not sure how, but you may manage it. You work all your life till you're 65, then you get to go to the Central Coast, and before you get your Zimmer frame, you start eating dinner about 2 in the afternoon, lunch at 10 a.m, and breakfast the night before. And then you die, and if you've been really bad, they put you in a box and put you in a hole. And if you've been really good, they put you in a box and put you in a hole. And don't you sometimes think there's got to be more than this? And I reckon that's part of what drives people to look for distractions. I think it's part of the reason why sport is so popular in Australia. Really, we love our sport. Why? Because it's a distraction. Until recently, the last couple of years, I lived in Wollongong. Beautiful place. On Sunday afternoons, if you drive around the town of Wollongong, you see a whole kind of pilgrimage of people dressed from head to foot in red and white on their way to Wynn Stadium. Dragons supporters. And I used to think, there's got to be a little bit more to life, hasn't there, than kind of turning up and living for following the Dragons. And I don't mean following Parramatta. I mean, there's just got to be a little more than that, hasn't there? Or people throw themselves into looking for the ultimate meal, you know, the foodies, or even it may just be watching television. Just anything that's kind of a distraction. And that feeling of there's got to be more than this, it's not just logic so much as it seems to be hardwired into us. So the philosophers have wrestled with that idea for thousands of years. The comedians pick it up and so on. Does anyone remember the Monty Python crowd, you know, the meaning of life and so on? They made fun of the whole idea. Or Douglas Adams. I don't think Douglas Adams has disappeared yet. His books, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and so on. So they're funny books about the meaning of life. I'd like to look with you today at words that were written close to 3,000 years ago, written by a great and wise man. It's from the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the books in the Old Testament part of the Bible. It's actually one of the wisdom books. What do I mean by that? The wisdom books stand a little apart from the main story of the Bible. Most of the Bible is one long story. The theologians call it a meta-narrative. A meta-narrative means one long story. It starts at Genesis, finishes at Revelation. It's the story of how God sets out to rescue his people and to actually remake creation. The wisdom books are just a little apart from that and actually look at trying to make sense or understand our world as it is. How do you live in a wise way in our world? Here's the wisdom books. Song of Solomon is actually a celebration of love, of the love between a husband and wife, a celebration of sexual love. It's kind of starry-eyed, not particularly romantic, but it's lots of fun. Proverbs, the next book, has a view of the world that kind of works on cause and effect. That is, if you're wise, you'll benefit. If you're foolish, you'll suffer. And you can see that so often in life. But that's not the whole picture, is it? Sometimes people who are good and innocent still suffer. And that's what the book of Job, the third book, deals with. Job is a good man who suffers, and the question is, well, if God is good and powerful, why do the innocent suffer? Job wrestles with that idea. And then we come to Ecclesiastes, which is all about trying to make sense of life in terms of meaning and purpose and what has value. So let me just read with you the kind of the introduction to the book of Ecclesiastes that we're going to look at over the next 7 more weeks. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. First thing, where does the name Ecclesiastes come from? You see there the words of the teacher. The word there, Kohelet, the Hebrew word, means someone who teaches in the assembly or teaches a big gathering of people. And the Greek word for gathering or group is ecclesia. And so it's Ecclesiastes, the gathering to be taught. Who is the teacher? Traditionally it's been taken as being Solomon. Although he never actually says it's Solomon. He says he was a king in Israel, a king after David. David and Solomon were around 1000 BC in ancient Israel. And so it's probably Solomon, although it's possible that it's written by a later writer through the eyes of Solomon, with all his money and power and wisdom and so on, kind of written through the experiences of Solomon. So we're not quite sure, but in these talks, I'll just call him Solomon. And you'll know what I mean. So what does he say? Well, as he looks around at life, it's not a happy picture that he sees. Verse 2, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Now this is a New International Translation, and so they've translated the word, the main word here, meaningless. It's the Hebrew word hebel, which means a mist or a vapour, something that's kind of transient, something that disappears, something that's fleeting. It's the idea, literally the idea of, you know, on a cold morning, you breathe out and then there's mist comes from your mouth, it's there and then it's gone. It's that feeling of something that you just can't grab hold of, the mist, the vapour, it's temporary. And so the English translations have, kind of ironically, have trouble getting a grip on it. And so meaninglessness is quite a good translation. The older King James Bible went for vanity, in the sense that it's all in vain, so they said vanity of vanities. It's the idea of being fleeting, transient, it doesn't last. And here, it's in its perfect form, so it's kind of meaninglessness of meaninglessnesses. The same idea as in the temple in ancient Israel was the Holy of Holies, the most holy place. Or the Song of Solomon is sometimes called the Song of Songs, the most beautiful song. And here he's saying it's meaningless, meaningless is all of life. If you want a popular culture version, Dumb and Dumber, okay, you've got the idea. What's he saying? All of life is like that. Everything is meaningless, it's temporary, it doesn't last. That's what he sees life as like. How has he come to that conclusion? It's through asking the question of verse 3. You see, here's the question he asks. What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? That's an absolutely crucial thing in understanding what this little book is about. What's he mean? The word gain is a commercial term. It's the idea of what is the profit, the dividend, the bottom line, what's the take-home value? What do you have left that's of value? What's the gain from all our labour, all our hard work, at which we toil under the sun? Under the sun, 27 times in the book, I think it is, 27 that he uses it. What's he mean? As far as I can work out, he means this. If we just had our common sense and our eyes and our ears open and we look out at life under the sun, how would we make sense of it? He's not writing from the point of view of the atheist. He knows that God is there. Just like surveys continue to show, the majority of people still believe in a God that who's there, a creator God. So he can see that God's there from creation and so on. But imagine if God hadn't spoken to us. Imagine if all we had was our eyes and our ears under the sun. And as we look out and try and see, how do we make sense of life? And he's saying, when you look out at life under the sun, it's meaningless, it's fleeting, it's a vapour, it's a mist, you can't grab hold of it. And you see, he begins, well, let's have a look around at what life is like. See verse 4. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. I think the point he's making is we are so insignificant in terms of time. Our lives are so brief compared to, well, here's it compared to the, Uluru. In 1999, my wife Kathy and I took our four kids, who were little then, 10, 11 years ago. We went on the kind of family vacation round Australia and ended up at Uluru. Now, the thing about Uluru and the outback, the hardest thing at Uluru is getting a parking spot. There's so many tourists there. So we pull up, we got our parking spot, and then we got in a tour with an Indigenous guide. And so this Aboriginal bloke took us around and taught us a whole lot of things about bushcraft and explained things about the rock and what they believed. It was good. And he said during the tour, they call the tourists who turn up ants. A-N-T-S, ants. I'm thinking, why? Except when you walk into the gift shop, it's obvious. And that is, in the gift shop there, they had a video player and they'd filmed the arrival of tourist buses and then it was speeded up 10, 15 times and you could see it happen from a distance. The tourist bus pull up and the tourists get off and then they take all these photos and some walk over the rock and some don't and then around and they mill around quickly and then they're back in the bus and they're gone. And you just see bus after bus of these ants zooming around there and then the rock in the background doesn't move. And that's what our lives are like, aren't they? Ants? Well, at least bugs hitting the windscreen of eternity. And that's just kind of, that's another life. And our lives are so brief. And things just go on and on and on. See verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south, turns to the north, round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. The Bible teaches the consistency of nature. And the idea is that the world operates consistently because God has set it up that way. God has made what we call laws of nature. That means that science is possible. It's a very good argument that's been made that the rise of science is actually came out of a Christian worldview, that the world could be studied, the world was reliable. That's not what he's saying here, though. What's he saying? It just goes on and on in endless fashion. It just... It's like a giant painting of the Sydney Harbour Bridge, kind of. It just, you get to one end and then it all starts again. See verse 7. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams come from, there they return again. And what he goes on to say is, look, we're only here for 5 minutes, and it's boring while we're here. Hey, verse 8. All things are wearisome, more than one can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. You can get bored with anything, really. The clearest example I've ever seen of it is on that same big holiday that I went on with Kathy about 10 years ago. We got to Darwin and I paid about an arm and a leg it cost for a bloke to take my daughter and myself barramundi fishing. And so we out of Darwin, onto the Adelaide River, I think it was, and we're on the mouth of the river, right kind of where the ocean and the river met, and... the river's about as wide as this building, I guess. And on the bank, literally just a little way away, are serious crocodiles. And the water's running and we've got... Now, I didn't catch a barramundi that day, but my daughter did, and I got a couple of salmon. And when the fish are on, it's every cast you get a strike, and my hands were literally shaking. I was so excited. It was just... And then you look at the fishing guide, and he was bored out of his brain. He was. It was just another day at the office and he couldn't wait to... And he became a fishing guide because he liked fishing, and after a little while, everything gets boring. It does. You see, he says, the eye never has enough of seeing. If you've got the travel bug and you want to go and see new places and you travel, does that cure the travel bug? No, it just feeds it, doesn't it? Ever notice how people who've had a year overseas travelling have trouble settling down when they come home because the eye never has enough of seeing? Or even something as kind of bland as television. Have you ever noticed there's nothing to watch? I was just in the UK recently, and the mate that I stayed with, he's got cable television, like 100 channels, and then he's got on-demand movies. And we sat down one night fairly late to try and find something to watch, and we spent 30 minutes going through 100 channels, and then going through all the demand movies, and after 30 minutes, we ended up starting to watch a French kung fu kind of martial arts police movie that he fell asleep after half an hour and I just went to bed. 57 channels and there's never anything to watch. Or the eye never has the ear never has its fill of hearing. How many songs do you reckon have been published since recording of songs was possible? I got onto Wikipedia, and there's someone there, obviously, who has too much time on their hands, has worked it out. And so he or she worked out so many record companies and so many records. Here's the answer they came up with. 2,100,000 songs since 1940. 2,100,000 songs. Don't you think that'd be enough? Really? Couldn't we just say, look, who's it now? Pink or Lady Gaga or whoever, right? Thanks, but look, stop. We've got enough songs. Thank you. Why do we need more and more and more? Because the ear never has enough. It's never enough. And nothing ever changes. See verse 9? What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already, long ago. It was here before our time. So the economy rises and falls in regular patterns. And governments take credit for it, or governments get blamed for it, but it still happens, up and down, up and down. Global financial crises, sure, the last one was a big one, but if you look back, there have been bigger falls in the stock market, and if you look, they happen every decade or so. Why do they happen? because it's the young ones that end up running the stock market. Right? But there's nothing new. Or federal governments and state governments argue about funding and so on. It's been happening forever. You might think, oh, no, no, wait. New technology, computers, that's something new. Well, yes, but it depends how you look at it. The rise of technology isn't new, and so technology has been on the up for thousands of years, from the fishing net to the internet, from the weaver's shuttle to the space shuttle, from the steam engine to the search engine. That was the only three that I could think of. But technology on the way up, and you know what? It hasn't solved our problems, has it? Our world is still full of greed and violence and hunger, and for all of the technology, nothing's changed. Now, it's not that bad, really. It's actually worse. If you look at verse 11, it is worse than that because no one will remember us either. See verse 11, there is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. No one will remember us. People don't remember. Let me give you an example. You see these four names: John Watson, George Reed, Andrew Fisher, and Joseph Cook. Don't call out, please, but could you just raise your hand if you know who these four guys, what it is about these four guys? One, two, three, maybe one person in 20, okay, 5%. Who were they? Well, they were Prime Ministers of Australia, and that means it happened in the last century. People don't remember our Prime Ministers. Will they remember us? What's even sadder is people don't remember people who truly were legends, like this man. This is Jack Gibson. He was a boyhood hero of mine. Some of you may remember him. Here he is. Well done, Russ. Jack Gibson died, I think it was last year, and he'd been my hero for maybe 30 years, I guess. A few months ago, I was speaking to a university student, age range, kind of early 20s. I talked about Jack Gibson. None of them knew him. Even those who like sport didn't know him. It's not just sport. Does anyone know who this man on the right is? Do you remember him? Right? Don Lane. Same thing. Don Lane, huge in the 70s and 80s in terms of entertainment. You talk to somebody kind of university student age, they have no idea who he is. People just don't remember. And you may think, oh, well, wait a minute, they'll remember my family. My family will remember me. Will they? This little shack, actually, this little stone building is on the Isle of Skye. What's it got to do with anything? About 3 weeks ago, I was there and went there for a couple of days to track down where my great-great-grandparents came from. In 1812, Roderick Shaw, my great-great-grandfather, was born in this little hut. No one remembers him. No one knew. The people who lived there, they didn't know that he'd been born. And the only reason I know about him is he got on a boat and came to Australia, and he died on the boat of typhus. And his wife arrived in Australia with seven children as a widow. And her fifth son is my great-grandfather. And that's an amazing story. That's all I know about them. And when I tell my children, they're not interested. The screensaver goes on in their head in about two sentences. And do you think your family will bother remembering you? No. No one remembers us. So I bet you're glad you came. So far, what have we established? The earth goes on forever and ever. We're only here for 5 minutes. We're bored while we are, and no one will remember us. The New Testament tells us that as well. In the book of James, as James writes to the Christian people, he says, James chapter 4, now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money, why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. And that's the way it is. Now, do you feel the weight of that? Because it's good to actually stop in the middle of Groundhog Day and busyness and kind of all the trivia that keeps us so busy and get our head up and think, life is brief. And how do we make sense of it? And there should be more than this, shouldn't there? And that feeling of there should be more than this is actually hardwired into us. It comes from God. Yes, there should be more than this. Tell you what the Bible tells us, though. This feeling of a frustration of the meaninglessness shouldn't be there, that things should work out, that things should make sense. It actually comes from God, that feeling, that kind of burden or frustration that we carry. I'll show you. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul writes to the Christians in Rome. And in the middle of that letter, in Romans chapter 8, I'll just show you one of the little things, one thing that he says. He says in Romans chapter 8, verse 20, "For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it." Now what's he mean? It's God who subjected creation to frustration. God's like put frustration on our world. When the scholars in the ancient world, when they came to translate the Old Testament, which is written in Hebrew, into Greek, they used that same word for frustration. So when Paul talks about the frustration of the world, he's actually talking about the same thing as the meaninglessness, this fleeting thing that Ecclesiastes is talking about. It's that feeling of there just should be more than this. Why is our world like it? Why does it frustrate us so much? The Bible's answer is that we've walked away from God, our Creator. The Bible tells us that as early as Genesis chapter 3, humanity walks away from God, and God has put this frustration on our world. It's a way of showing us that all is not right. And so the tragedies, the boredom, the disappointments, the heartaches, it's actually, in a way, the severe mercy of God. It's like, in a way, that pain can be a good thing. What I mean is pain is a good thing if it's telling you that something's wrong. If your leg is broken and it doesn't hurt, you're going to do serious damage. The fact that it hurts tells you to go and fix it. And so this frustration, God's put it there, and it's also to point us to the fact that God promises to renew our world one day and to renew those people who will trust him. So where does that leave us? Ecclesiastes begins by saying, look, there's nothing under the sun, there's nothing that's just that we just see and so on that has meaning and value and purpose. You think, oh, no, wait, there must be something. You see people throw themselves into, you know, pleasure or partying or achievement or success or wealth, all of those things that our world focuses on. They've got to give meaning and purpose and last. And, no, here's what the rest of the book is about. Solomon decides to set out on a quest to see what it is that has meaning and purpose, what lasts, what has value under the sun, what gain is left. And he goes and examines all of these different things, and he has all the money and all the wisdom and all the time in the world as he goes and looks. And what I'd ask is, if you'd like to come with me over the next 7 weeks and actually look at his quest as he looks under the sun for what gives life meaning and purpose. And I want to tell you, it's actually disturbing. It's troubling because he rattles the cage on things, right? and shows the problems with what we live for. It's disturbing, but it's actually good for us, because you wouldn't want to get to the end of life and realise that we've lived for what's actually been a vapour, for what's been fleeting and not worthwhile. When he gets to the end of the book, there is an answer. It's an answer that's actually shocking. It's an answer that, if you embrace it, changes everything. It changes all of life. And so I'd invite you to read ahead in Ecclesiastes, right there. We're handing out the booklet, aren't we, of all the texts of Ecclesiastes, and to come back over the next 7 weeks as we work through the book.
Thank you so much, Al. Well, this is your time. If you'd like to write down any questions specifically about the talk today, or about the portion of the Bible that Al was able to speak on today, as Al had mentioned inside of your outline, we do have the book of Ecclesiastes, actually, right there. So you're more than welcome to read through that. We do have on the tables, too, the study guide for this series. You're more than welcome to take that with you, too, looking at it in a little bit more in depth, and also just to come back and prepare it with other questions. All right. Al, have we given you enough time?
Yep.
Fantastic.
Okay, the first question is a good question. I'm sorry I was rushing things a little bit, running out of time. In Romans 8, chapter 20, you said that the word frustration is the same as the Hebrew word meaning vapor. Is this correct? I've cut a few corners. Here we go. The Hebrew word in Ecclesiastes, meaningless, is hebel, H-E-B-E-L. That's kind of the alliteration for it. That's Hebrew. in Romans 8:20, the word for frustration is the Greek word mataiates. But when they came to translate them, that's how they translated hebel as mataiates. Okay, that's the Hebrew. So as Paul comes to write about God's putting this frustration on our world, he actually reached back to the same idea as in Ecclesiastes. That's the link. You've just got to trouble. Old Testament written in Hebrew, New Testament written in Greek, both translated into English. It can just get a little bit tricky, although you still get the meanings, no trouble. The other question, if life is meaningless, what purpose is there in trying to, quote, get ahead? That's an excellent question and a beautiful lead into next week. Read Ecclesiastes chapter 2. That's what it's all about. Saying, well, maybe the meaning of life is in getting ahead. And literally, Solomon was one of the richest men in the ancient world. And if you had all the money in the world, what would you do? He did it. What did he decide at the end? Ecclesiastes chapter 2.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.